Which is getting harder to tell myself, considering we were talking about a dining room.
Ah, yes. It looked as if it was ready to host a meal as well. In fact, all of the tables had been set as if they were preparing to serve a dinner for one of the large family gatherings. The plates and wine glasses were sat empty, ready to be filled for guests. But they remained undisturbed through the passing of years, entertaining only dust and cobwebs. All except for one. The head seat of the center table had its chair pulled out, leaving streaks against the dust of the wood floor. There were faint hoof prints near the table which circled the room and ended at the carpeted hallway. "Hello," I said, calling out over the empty chairs, but of course was met with no response.
So they hadn't taken anything? Maybe that means they had planted roots in the manor.
I didn't know, but my hopes were waning. Even with the hoofprints, enough dust had resettled that they were surely long gone. Feeling deflated, I proceeded over to the east wing, passing the organ again. These hallways contained all of the guest bedrooms. Most of them had some kind of luggage and travel supplies. It looked like quite a few family members were there, visiting before the bombs fell. But none of them had been lived in for some time. I continued circling the wing until I found myself at the organ again, so I proceeded upstairs. By this point, I had given up on the idea of finding anyone at all. The mansion seemed long abandoned. I started with the east wing this time. Again, I found mostly bedrooms, but these were much more decorated and personalized. Clearly, they had belonged to the family members who lived at Maricello. Soon, I noticed one of them had a terminal, although I had to look twice at it. It didn't look like any terminal I'd ever seen before. I sat down, tapped on the keys, and was bathed in a gentle blue light. The logo and styling of the screen were quite different from the familiar green StableTech logo.
I don't think I've ever seen a terminal that wasn't made by StableTech.
Neither had I. Instead, the home screen was branded with the name East Corp.
East, like the direction?
Exactly. It was an odd interface to use, but once I got past the aesthetic differences, it was familiar enough. It was a simple, personal console, with an email left open.
Dear Harpsichord, I apologize again that I was not able to make this year's fall festival. I've been held up in New York because of a recent bomb scare. They shut down all the trains leaving the city and most of the subways as well. Almost nothing is open. I've been cooped up in my hotel room while the ministry is investigating. Ugh, it's driving me stir-crazy. Thanks a lot, Four Stars Rail. I do hope Crescendo isn't too upset. I was looking forward to playing with him at the family concert. His newest organ piece sounds beautiful, and it's been much too long since I've been back home. I want to hear more about the stallion you've mentioned. I'll try calling you next week. Send my love to the others. Amoria.
It sounds like they were all still very close.
They were. It seemed like no matter how far the oratorios moved, they remained in contact with one another. Having an annual reunion must have really helped hold them together as a family. However, Amoria's email did not intrigue me as much as the unsent response.
Oh, Amoria, it was so nice to hear from you. Truth be told, it's probably better that you were not here. I didn't want to dampen your spirits because I do wish more than anything that you were here, but I've been dreading this year's fall festival. My father has not been well lately. I expect to have to calm him down off of one of his tirades at the big dinner. Heaven knows no one else will say a word. But it's more than just his usual temper. I think the war has been upsetting him more than any of us anticipated, and we've been dealing with the consequences. This last year has been a series of fights and bad situations as he's been having his big surprise prepared for everyone to see. At least it's given Mother and I an excuse to sample more of our wine stocks. Regardless, it would probably be better if we talked about this over the phone. I'd much like to call you after tonight's concert if you're free. I'd be more than happy to save you from the boredom if you'd save me from this weekend. Talk to you soon. Much love, Harpsy.
And that's where the letter stopped, in the middle of her name, as if she were called away from the console before she could send it.
How strange.
I was about to shut down the terminal when I noticed a few sound files they had sent back and forth to one another, including some of Amoria's songs and the organ piece she had mentioned. Curious to hear the samplings, I plugged my pipbook into the console to download them.
Hold on. If you're going to give me new Amoria songs, you might just become my new best friend. Same goes for the rest of you Wastelanders. If you come across any music in your travels, you just bring DJ Pony a copy, and I'll be sure to broadcast them for all to hear.
Well, I'm afraid in my case, you're going to be disappointed. My pitbook was only plugged in for a few seconds when sparks started shooting out from both sides of the cable. My pitbook screen turned the same blue coloring before I unplugged it. One final arc of electricity erupted from the gap and melted away part of the terminal's casing and slot. Had I left it in any longer, I feared it would have done the same to me.
Yikes. Talk about not playing well with others. I've heard of faulty terminals, but those are usually rigged as exploding traps because the wasteland is full of dear hearts and gentle ponies.
Well, luckily, it didn't turn me into a rose salad.
So, now that you were done with the terminal, and it was done with you, what happened next?
Well, I continued out of Harpsichord's room and passed by a few others. Many of them had the same blue East Corp terminals, but none of them contained anything of interest. I continued walking down the East Wing hallway, when I heard a loud slam behind me. Startled, I spun around quickly while magically drawing my carbine rifle. But as I aimed down its iron sights, I didn't see anything there. It was just the same dust floating in the hallway. I crept slowly towards the origin of the sound, passing by all the rooms again. That's when I found that Harpsichord's bedroom door had been shut, and not by me. I opened it slowly and peered back inside. No one was there, and the window was closed. I crept up to look inside the open closet, but was met with only dresses and shoes. Then, out of the corner of my eye, I spotted a purple glow. Spinning around again, I saw a small fire crackling out of the back of the terminal, casting a flickering light against the lavender wall. Using one of the coats from the closet, I smothered the flames. But with the terminal extinguished, I still noticed a flickering on the wall. I glanced around again until I noticed a scented candle on the nightstand by the bed. The small flame danced by itself, while a pleasant fresh linen aroma filled the room. However, the candle was on the other side of the room from the terminal, and I hadn't lit it because I didn't know it was there. I checked under the bed and around the room one last time, still finding nothing. As I left, I shut the door myself and all the other doors I'd opened as well.
Perhaps you'd finally found the pony that had been in the dining room?
I didn't know, but the incident left me flustered, so I kept my carbine at the ready just in case. At the end of the hallway, I opened the last door to find the master bedroom. It was a very luxurious suite with a large bed in the center. Above the headboard was a family portrait showing 6 earth ponies. The 4 at the bottom were the children, 2 sons and 2 daughters. They were dressed in their finest as though they were off to attend a wedding or grand gala. The youngest daughter, to the bottom right, was Harpsichord. She was a lovely young mare in her late 20s. She had an orange mane and tail with a hazel coat, all brought together with green, almond-shaped eyes. Standing above them was the patriarch of the family. He was an aged stallion, possibly in his 60s, with a grey coat, his mane and tail turned white with age, matching a well-groomed moustache. His eyes were a sharp reddish-brown. This was Crescendo, standing proudly with his wife and children. They looked happy enough as a family, posing in front of the grand pipe organ. I didn't know what could have unhinged Crescendo so much as to distress Harpsichord and the others. Then again, the picture could have been older. The walls behind the organ were white as opposed to the lavender that now covered the house. Even still, I wanted to know what this big surprise was that he had been working on. How could a caring father let himself become so twisted up in something that he would lose control of his temper? Then I caught myself while standing there pondering. I hadn't realized it at first, but I had been walking the manor for several hours. I was growing invested in them, this, my missing family, who were driven away by crueler ancestors. I wanted to get to know them as much as I could, because, with every age and every season, we are nothing if not the legacy of days past.
That's very true. It must have meant a lot to you.
I was still embracing it all, but it was hard to take in a moment for a different reason. The master bedroom looked as though it had been claimed. On one of the tables sat some supplies and food provisions, which were clearly recent post-war additions to the suite. Next to them sat a box of these very strange batteries, a kind I had not seen before. Gathered around the bed were a variety of other items some travelers had set up and were apparently living there. The only item on the bed was an Instashot camera. And let's just say, the photos revealed why the sheets were in such a disheveled state.
Well, that's something you don't come across every day.
Oh yes, they were quite explicit. It seemed the settlers were a mare and stallion couple. One thing I noticed them wearing, because it was the only thing they were wearing, were pip bucks. They must have come from a stable somewhere.
Stable 69, perhaps?
Well, that would be a good guess. They sure hadn't held back. There were several empty wine bottles scattered about as well, all of them with Maricello labels. Regardless, I figured they wouldn't have just left all the supplies behind. It looked like almost everything they could carry was still sitting in the master bedroom. For all I knew, they probably stumbled upon the manor in their travels and decided to celebrate the find by breaking in the queen-sized bed.
I'd be lying if I said I wouldn't probably do the same thing as well.
They had definitely made themselves comfortable, and apparently fallen prey to the same mistake as me. In one corner of the room was another one of the East Corp terminals, this one a bit larger than harpsichords. But unlike harpsichords, which I had effectively destroyed, the screen was still glowing in active blue, despite the obvious burn mark around the access port.
Oftentimes, larger really is better.
The terminal didn't survive unscathed, however. The main directory was a collection of nonsense, as most of the files had been corrupted by the failed interaction. There were luckily a few emails and journal entries still legible enough. From what I was able to read, it seemed Crescendo sat on the board of directors for several companies of his day. All of them seemed to be corporations founded by oratorios at one point or another. They had been kept in the family throughout the years, and all seemed to respect Crescendo's cunning and business acumen. One of the few surviving journal entries that didn't relate to work was much more disturbing. The language is not at all ladylike, but I feel to censor the words would detract from the understanding of who he was.
It doesn't bother me, and I'm pretty sure most wastelanders are used to foul speech just from walking past raider nests.
Indeed. Well, following some corrupted characters at the beginning, the entry read as follows.
I should have known. Those stupid, money-grubbing, stable tech fucks. You need a justifiable interest for me to want to have a stable to keep my family safe? I could give a damn what stable is designated for my region. I don't buy your horseshit for one second. I'm not even surprised. Knowing how many of their people come from Manchester, and their debased runic magics sparking away in their technology. I never trusted them before, and I was a fool to think they'd be anything different. It doesn't matter. You think you hold power over us? That your bigotry can deny my family's safety from a war you had a hoof in? Well, you don't. I will protect my family from the twilight of our civilization. I will see that they live through the balefire, no matter the cost, no matter the sacrifice. We will survive.
Well then, at least he's not bitter.
No, he really wasn't. Because it wasn't bitterness I read in his words. It was hatred. A deep-seated hatred that had lasted through the centuries. Their hearts were still broken from the injustices Manchester had wrought upon them. One prejudice had simply given birth to another.
It might not have been like that for all of them. Even if some of them held grudges, I'm sure most of the others had forgiven and moved past it.
Perhaps. Or maybe he was just the most vocal of them. There wasn't much else on the terminal. I decided to go back out into the hallway and over to the west wing of the second floor. It was the only part of the main manor I hadn't visited yet. I took one of the strange batteries with me, looking it over as I walked. The hallways themselves left an uneasy feeling in the pit of my stomach. I could understand family reverence to an extent, but passing by dozens of oratorios staring out from their picture frames was, in a word, creepy.
Yeah, not exactly the place I'd go on vacation.
Once I reached the end of the hallway, I opened the double doors to discover another familiar sight. A large library. Even after centuries of separation, the oratorios seem to contain the same devotion to history as our family in Manchester. Of course, being a history of musicians, there were quite a few vinyl records and holotapes shelved alongside the books.
None of which you grabbed along the way, did you?
Sorry, no, I don't have a secret reserve of music hoarded from an adventure I had over a decade ago.
I know, but it's a library of musicians. You're killing me over here.
Oh, I'll make it up to you. How about something a little more comfortable for this drab gray studio space?
Well, since you put it so nicely.
Anyway, the inside of the library was gorgeous, fitting with the rest of the mansion's decor. An observation window covered the entire west wall, looking out over a swampy, mutated plantation. A strange light shone through the window from the horizon, pouring over the reading area from the orange-colored sky. It was nearly sunset. It seemed I would be staying the night at Maricello.
And there was still no sign of the two travelers?
Not in the library. Only the tomes and recordings of hundreds of ponies recanting their achievements and accomplishments, including, on the far north wall, the records of a very familiar branch of my family tree, Oakroot the Silent.
You're kidding me. They still kept a chronology of his life? I would have thought that, given the circumstances, they would have completely separated themselves from their Manchester roots.
As did I, but there he was. His name and section sat below the familiar image of him I'd seen a thousand times in my youth. It was a portrait that was made several centuries after his death. He lived in an age when most of his neighbors were still warring tribes, conquering each other's islands with axes and wooden ships. The artist's impression of him had been based on several cruder drawings from his day and the descriptions given by those who knew him. He stood tall, nearly 6 feet high. He carried a strong presence about him for many reasons, not the least of which was his imposing stature. He had a chocolate-brown coat with dark emerald eyes. His grey, shaggy mane and beard blew gently in the breeze as he looked out over the ivory cliffs, a simple, earthy green cloak draped over him. It brought a tear to my eye, seeing his face in such an unlikely place.
He sounds like a great stallion.
He was. Their collection held many of the same books we had, while missing several of the ones that had been written about him after the fact. In fact, the only writings not authored by him were those penned while he was still alive, or shortly thereafter. Much of the expansions and developments the Unicorns of Manchester had made to his works were simply omitted.
So it seems the respect started and ended with Oakroot.
Yes, which left the collection very limited. Oakroot earned his title, the Silent, because he spoke very little. So little, in fact, that even in his soft, almost harsh tone, everyone immediately took notice and listened when he did say something. His writings were no different. His original scrolls totaled not more than a few dozen pages each, but every word was profound and carefully chosen. As such, his entire philosophy on runes, governance, magic, and society totaled a mere 12 works. However, every Filian cult in Manchester grew up studying them in every detail.
Well, at least the chapters are short.
However, as I looked over the bindings, I came across a 13th tome on race, equality, and magic by Oakroot, First Regent, Kingdom of Manchester. I was dumbfounded, staring at this deuteronomical text. Another writing by Oakroot? Why had I never seen this before? I took it with me to one of the couches and began reading while bathed in the evening light. At first, I felt this must be a fraud, an uncanonized work attributed to him after the fact. But the more I read, the more I was convinced it was indeed penned by Oakroot. His writing had a very distinct voice to it. His ideas flowed like the wind passing around trees in a forest. Only when leaving the forest do you realize they were all part of the same tree. This was an incredible find because Oakroot's writings were essentially the cornerstone of our civilization, The Foggy Isles lived by these edicts and philosophies for over a millennia. Even under the princesses of Equestria, they formed an important part of our history and culture, which is why the discovery of this 13th work was so devastating to me. On race, equality, and magic was Oakroot's treatise on why he ever took interest in runic magic in the first place. For him, it went far beyond a curiosity or thirst for arcane discovery. Runic magic was how he thought he could bring true equality between all races of ponies. It was a way to give magic to earth ponies and Pegasi beyond what was naturally available to them. He had grandiose ideas for artificial wings and horseshoes so that earth ponies and unicorns could walk on clouds and fly like the Pegasi. They were not ideas I was reading for the first time, but it was the first time I was hearing them come from Oakroot. The Foggy Isles had not taken this approach to runic magic at all. From the very beginning, most of the writings and studies were pursuing ways to augment the magic that unicorns already had. Unicorns were the majority of the population, so to an extent it made sense. But there, I discovered that Oakroot's reason for the whole pursuit was to bring equality to the races, not further division. I had grown up assuming those kinds of magics led to dead ends, that only unicorns had the capability to interact with runes, in the same way that only Pegasi can interact with clouds. And the unicorns of Manchester seemed to prefer it that way, hence the stories of earth ponies being demons and sorcerers. But would that still be true if our society had shared an Oakroot's dream to pursue those discoveries? And furthermore, why was I only finding this work here? For the first time in a mansion of family members we had grown apart from over 1,000 years ago. Manchester had completely rejected the righteous endeavors of our greatest ancestor and used his accomplishments for our own selfish gain. It was then that I understood why Oakroot's picture was there. The Oratorios had known for 1,000 years that they were cast out despite the ideals of their forefather. Our forefather. It was no wonder why they hated us, having this constant reminder that their shared birthright was stolen from them.
That would definitely cast a long shadow over their past. What an awful thing to discover.
Awful as it was also very empowering for me. I felt like I'd found the resolution I was searching for. The Oratorios might have been long gone, but with that book, I could go back and change Manchester for the better. I could truly make it a new Manchester to help us rise above what we once were.
And that is ultimately the reason to scavenge for things in the first place. We utilize the broken pieces of the past so that we can build ourselves a better future.
I felt very happy I could finally put the Oratorios to rest, at least in my mind. I decided I would stay in the master bedroom for the night and head out on the road in the morning. I left the reading area and walked back to Oakroot's section to look one more time to see if I'd missed anything else. I pushed the books to one side and another, but found nothing. So, I packed the 13th book away in my saddlebag. Then I pressed all the books up against the right side to straighten them out, which rattled the picture frame. Oakroot's portrait was leaning slightly to one side, so I reached up and straightened it. It was then that I heard a metal click, and watched as Oakroot's face was bathed in shadow. The edges of the sunset were receding away from the frame. I stepped back, startled, until the section of wall had completely slid inward, revealing a hidden doorway.
A hidden doorway? Did it lead to an underground railroad?
No. I couldn't tell what was inside. It was pitch black beyond the edges of the bookcases. But ironically, a piece of StableTech technology would shed some light. I turned on my pipbuck lamp and walked in slowly with my carbine rifle at the ready. I didn't have far to walk. It only took me a few steps to see the portrait again. The secret room was long and thin, not much wider than a hallway. It was clearly planned and concealed by the false wall that ran along the north side of the library. I began following the wall as my pipbuck lamp illuminated only a few feet in front of me. The first thing I came across was a desk that had an assortment of books and papers on it. Mixed among them were pages of sheet music for the organ. The room was some kind of hidden workspace kept by Crescendo. The books themselves explained why the room was hidden behind Oakroot's portrait. All of the writings were related to runic magics of various kinds. Apart from Oakroot's work, there were volumes related to the talisman magics of the native pony cultures. Saddle Arabian tablet spells, buffalo curses, giraffe incantations. It appeared that Crescendo was studying every kind of magic from every culture, including several spellbooks on the glyph magic created by the zebras.
It sounds like he was toying with dangerous forces. Each one of those are powerful enough on their own. What was he intending on doing with all of them together?
He was clearly looking for something specific. He had notes and markings scribbled in the borders of the pages. The walls were covered in hoof-written sheets where he was combining the different kinds of spells together in different ways. I could identify bits and pieces of Manchester magic, but most of it was completely foreign to me. I was getting more and more anxious. The pages seemed to get less coherent the further I went into the room. The sheets were more crumpled or torn, and the markings were written in heavier pen, sometimes puncturing through the page. I also began seeing an increase in the number of zebra glyphs he was using. It had reached the point where they were the dominant form of magic he was experimenting with. Finally, I reached the end of the room. Sitting there, in front of the last wall, was a shrine that even raiders would find horrific. It rose from the floor in a frame made of bones. But not just bones, they had been carved into and covered in gems of various shapes and sizes. Each gem was etched with its own symbol. All of the gems touched, each threw a yellowish sap of some kind which ran through all the skeletal pieces, like marrow. Holding the abomination together were sections of dried leathery skin. In the center of the shrine was a bowl of thick, brownish-black ooze. It was some kind of liquid solution which had evaporated over time, leaving only the foul-smelling muck behind. Rising out of the bowl of ooze was a preserved and mummified head. The skin was covered in symbols in various colors, and the muscles had distorted to the point that I couldn't even tell if it came from a pony or zebra. It sat there, staring up at me with its lifeless eyes. I walked backwards slowly, too shaken to turn my back to the monstrosity. It grew dark as I stepped away from it, until finally I galloped quickly out of the hidden doorway and vomited.
By the goddesses!
What in all that is holy had he done? All the different bones and skin! Several creatures had died to make that altar, not to mention the head. Was this the big surprise Harpsichord had mentioned? Did she know about this? Were they all involved? The thoughts swelled in my brain like a swarm of angry bees. Once I composed myself, I noticed how dark everything had become. The sun had totally disappeared over the horizon. If it weren't for the cloud barrier, I would have been able to see the stars in the sky. It was in that small moment of darkness that I was suddenly deafened. A mighty roar echoed through the hallways. It happened so quickly that only when I uncovered my ears did I realize what the sound was. What I thought was a cacophony of shrieks and howls, I soon recognized as a melody traveling through the house. The pipes of the massive organ called out as if they were the voices of the earth itself. Instinctively, I drew out my rifle and hovered it in the direction of the organ. There was a long pause. Nothing else was happening. The instrument simply bellowed its song, which seemed to shake the walls. Then, I saw a faint glow beginning to appear at the end of the hallway. I yelled out in my most authoritative voice, "Halt! Don't move!" The glow continued to get closer and closer. "Stop!" I cried again. My pitbuck light was casting a green-tinged glow around the edge of the hallway, so whether or not the pony could hear me over the organ shouldn't have mattered. As it continued moving through the hallway, the candelabras beside the portraits would ignite as it passed by. The passage was slowly accented with dim orange candle flames. They hardly stood out, though, because what came into view was an irradiant, pony-shaped being, glowing with a bright, lavender light. I decided I had waited enough. The SAT's targeting spell appeared in my vision. I took aim at the creature's head and fired. The 44 Magnum bullet exploded out of the barrel of my carbine rifle and sailed through the air. In a fraction of a second, it reached its target and passed right through. The pony continued its slow trot towards me, another set of candles lighting on either side of it. I cocked the lever and fired another round, this time through its chest. Once again, the bullet failed to slow it at all, passing through what should have been its heart, lung, stomach, and tail.
Was it a hologram of some kind?
I had covered almost the whole mansion before that, and hadn't seen any holographic projectors, just a few security cameras placed in different spots. The creature had almost reached the library now. I was stepping back further into the room, angling to the right to see if it had a weak spot on its side. I fired one more time where its eye would be. The lead projectile flew through the creature and struck the frame of one of the portraits behind it. Bits of wood cracked and splintered as it flew through the air. It was the sound of the picture frame hitting the ground that finally caused the creature to stop. In the momentary pause, I took a good look at it. The being was roughly the size of an average adult mare. She was transparent. I could easily see through her purple-tinted frame. The outline of her body glowed the brightest lavender shade, but every inch of her gave off some light. The outline was not perfectly defined, though. The edges of her mane and tail seemed to be flowing, so to speak, as if her hair was pouring down, then swirling around and flowing back into her head. The bottom of her hooves were the same way. The edges of her fetlocks poured down into what looked like a cloud at the bottom of each ankle. While looking at her feet, I noticed one of her back legs was breaking apart. The outer side of the leg poured off like smoke from a chimney. The cloud trailed along the floor towards the picture frame. I looked up and saw that a similar smoke had begun pouring out of the bullet hole where I had shot through the portrait. The smoke poured over the place on the wall that the picture once covered. Inscribed behind the frame was one of the strange magical glyphs. It glowed just as brightly as the phantom that stood before me.
Phantom? You mean like a ghost? A disembodied spirit? They could easily have been some kind of enchantment or decoy spell.
I didn't know what else to think of them. I was sure I was staring at one of the souls that were slain to make that altar of bones. Horrible visions filled my head of Crescendo sneaking off in the middle of the night to raid villages for bodies, whether they were dead or alive. Soon, the amorphous cloud began to take shape, lifting the broken picture as its limbs and head flowed from the center. A second, fully formed specter had materialized. It held the portrait in its hoof, still splintered and twisted from the gunshot. But from the creature's hoof flowed out more of the glowing cloud. It covered the frame and began pulling it back together, as if time were moving in reverse. Every splinter returned to its place, until the portrait was whole once again. It was not exactly the same, though. Lavender scars remained where the wood had been stitched back together. The bullet hole in the wall had mended itself as well. The pony holding it returned the picture to its rightful place. Both phantoms stared at it for a long moment. Then, in perfect unison, they both turned to face me.
Oh, and I'm not going to sleep tonight.
They both entered the library, following me as I fired a few more times and galloped down one of the aisles. They were not fast. Their walk wasn't much faster than a canter. Although walking doesn't really describe how they moved, their legs made walking motions, but the clouds at their heels blurred together into a single amorphous trail that they glided on. Their leg motions didn't even sync up with their speed, so it looked as if they were moving much slower than they actually were. The candles in the chandeliers above us were set alight as the phantoms passed beneath them. They were closing in on me from two sides, driving me into a corner. I felt a bump as my tail was pressed up against the observation window. Using the butt of my rifle, I pounded on the glass, trying to break it. I struck it several times, but it failed to even crack. Panicking, I quickly inscribed an explosion spell on the glass, the same one I had used to get through the front gate. With a spark, the runes glowed bright orange and erupted. The force knocked me backwards into one of the couches. Looking up, I watched as the glass expanded outward in a million tiny shards. But instead of toppling to the ground below, they stayed connected together through an arcing streaks of purple energy. As soon as my spell dissipated, the shards were pulled back into place as quickly as they were dislodged. The window had completely resealed, this time looking like the stained glass window of an ancient cathedral.
It just fused itself back together?
Like it had been designed that way, as a purple web. I stood on the couch with my mouth agape and pupils the size of pinpricks. In my shock, I failed to notice one of the phantoms approaching to my left. I spun my head just as its arm reached for my left hind leg. The moment it touched my boot, the leather began to burn like it was tossed into a fire. I recoiled backwards and used the leverage on the couch to jump over the other phantom. My boot continued to sizzle, so I quickly ripped it off with magic and galloped down the hallway. The organ was still playing as loudly as ever. When I reached the staircases, I looked over the banister as I ran down. Out of the flues of the organ's pipes, the lavender smoke poured out like a waterfall. It collected in front of the organ like a morning fog. The gold power lever had been switched back on. The keys and pedals of the instrument seemed to play on their own or under influence of the glowing purple smoke flowing over them. Once reaching the bottom of the stairs, I ran for the front door, praying that I'd be able to escape there. I pulled on the handles with all my might, but even with every muscle and every bit of magic in my body, I simply couldn't get them to budge. I spun around, looking for any other exits I could find. All around me, more and more of the phantoms came filing in from the hallways. They had the atrium surrounded and forced me away from the doors. I galloped back and forth, trying to find an opening, but they just kept coming. They closed me in until I was caught between the backs of the staircases and the pipe organ.
How many of them were there?
Dozens. They came down the stairs, all four hallways. I couldn't even vault over them like I had before because the circle was at least two creatures deep. It felt as though they were trying to force me into the cloud that had collected in front of the organ. I stared at it in fear as a shape began rising out of the cloud. All of the smoke gathered together around the keys of the organ, rising like ash from a volcano. It took form as two arms and a head, flowing out from the pipes as they continued to play. Unlike the beings that surrounded me, this creature stared at me with two bright red eyes, which glowed like the balls of energy at the top of a dynamo. I stepped back as the creature began to lean closer to me. It was then that I felt a wave of unimaginable pain overtake my leg, the one without a boot. I jerked away as the whiff of lavender smoke reformed the arm of one of the phantoms. A long patch between my ankle and knee was sizzling as the purple cloud continued to seep off of it. All of the hair had been burned off in an instant, and my skin was sickly and oozing down three layers. I barely stumbled a few feet when I collapsed, my leg burning with every flex of the muscle. I was laying on my side with my legs suspended in the air as jolts of pain continued to shoot up my spine. My dress had been bunched up from the fall, leaving my flank and tail uncovered. In an instant, the organ had stopped playing. The creature floating before it was no longer looking me in the eye, but was transfixed by my mark. The royal seal of Manchester, which was now exposed for all to see. The quiet was so unsettling that even in my pain, I noticed the absence of the organ. The horror loomed above me, its face twisting and retching as its ghostly jaw pulled open. It let out a wail so terrible it sounded like the dying screams of a thousand different creatures. Even the other phantoms seemed to recoil at the horror's cry. I staggered backwards in terror, the burn on my leg becoming comparatively tolerable. I was backed up against the door of one of the locked closets behind the stairs. The horror continued to wail as the organ began sounding as well. Several keys played a horrible, discordant sound. I was still slumped on the floor and started reaching up for anything I could to grab onto so I could get back on my feet. I took hold of the door handle, but as I tugged at it, the door opened up behind me and I tumbled backwards down a staircase.
So, is this the part where you tell me that they ate your soul and you've come here to haunt Ten Pony Tower?
Shh, don't spoil the ending. Why do you presume I'd haunt you?
There's nothing to presume. If you hung around here with ghostly dressmaking skills, I wouldn't have a cap to my name as long as Homage is here.
Well, I'll have to keep that in mind for later. They say you can't take anything with you, but that'd be a moot point if I stayed here.
We could call you the Ghost of Fabulosity Past, and you could frighten us all with your attempts at singing holiday songs.
Oh, you are so getting haunted now.
But I guess that'll have to wait, because it doesn't sound like you broke your neck on that tumble down the stairs.
Luckily, no. When I reached the bottom, besides a few bruises, the only thing really damaged was my leg. While I was alarmed that someone had unlocked the door, I was grateful that the closet ended up leading to a cellar. It was the change of luck I needed. I rolled to a stop against a tall wooden rack that went to the ceiling. My body bumping against it made a distinctive clinking sound. The wooden rack was full of wine bottles, all adorned with the same Maricello labels I had seen on the empty ones in the bedroom. When I opened my eyes, I saw something else familiar. Sticking out from an empty wine slot was one of the strange batteries the traveling couple had brought with them. I magically pulled on it and felt something much heavier come with it. The battery was attached to what looked like a pistol. It plugged into one side of the mouth grip, which was then connected to the barrel with some wiring. I spun the pistol around a few times, getting a good look at it. The gauge on the barrel was too small for any kind of bullets, so my first thought was that it was some kind of battery-powered BB gun. On the side of the gun, someone had carved a warning, a do not aim at face.
I love some of the names people will come up with for their guns.
Despite my partial daze and fascination with the toy, I realized that one of the phantoms had followed me down the stairs. I yelped and aimed the gun at the creature out of instinct. With the press of the trigger, I fired right into its face. But instead of a small copper BB, the gun exploded with a beam of bright yellow light. The blast was blinding and hot. I had to shield my eyes.
That is definitely not a toy.
As I stood up, I faced the creature. There was a hole through the phantom's head, as if someone had punched a hoof through it. The laser beam had blown away half its face in a single shot. The phantom had even been pushed back a few feet.
That really is the beauty of energy weapons. They might be rare, but they pack a wallop.
My satisfaction didn't last, though. Within moments, small sparks of energy began surging around the hole as the purple cloud started filling it back in. Not wasting any time, I hobbled deeper into the wine cellar. I ran as fast as I could without my leg giving out from under me. I was surrounded by wine bottles on all sides. In any other circumstance, it would have been a dream come true.
Ain't that the truth?
But I couldn't indulge in that fantasy because behind each wine rack was another one of the modified zebra glyphs. I kept moving until I came to a pneumatic door marked Generator Room. I tapped on the panel, but it didn't open. I tried to open it manually, but the lever wouldn't budge.
It's just like I said, those pneumatic doors always jam up at the worst possible moments.
I pounded on the lever a few more times, but had to give up. I saw the purple smoke start to pour down from the ceiling. So, I kept running along the wall, looking for another door.
Why didn't you just blow it open with another rune spell?
I didn't have the energy. Even basic runic spells take a lot out of you. I was using whatever latent energy I could just to keep the weight off my leg. I didn't even have enough to keep the laser pistol floating. I had to hold it in my mouth. I turned the corner at the end of that hallway of wine bottles and found my exit. Between four big fermentation tanks was a large metal door that had been slid open. It looked like a barn door, but was made out of the same bunker-grade titanium that Stable 79 was made of. Unfortunately, one of the phantoms had just finished forming and was going to beat me to it. So, I triggered my Pipbuck's targeting spell and fired. My aim was a bit off, but the laser still blasted right through its neck. With one more shot, I could have taken its head off. I kept stumbling until I made it through the titanium barn door. Another of the phantoms was right behind me, so I tried to fire again. I pressed the trigger with my tongue, but heard only a pathetic click. The battery was dead. I struggled to pull out the other one I had placed in my saddlebag, but in my haste I lost focus on my leg and fell again from a jolt of pain. I turned towards the creature as it reached out to grab me. But as its leg passed through the door's boundary, the luminescent light that formed its body disappeared. The radiant glow flickered out like a candle flame under a glass. The creature jolted to a halt as we both watched its leg float to the ceiling like a harmless puff of smoke. The phantom backed up a few steps to let its leg reform, and then it tried coming through head first. But as it passed through the frame of the door, it dissolved away inch by inch.
The smoke from the creature's body floated to the ceiling and dissipated as it mixed with the rest of the air in the room. I gazed out from the 10 by 10 foot opening and saw nearly a dozen other phantoms staring blankly. They didn't try to approach me. They just looked at the spot where the first creature had vaporized.
What on earth was going on?
I glanced around the room I was standing in. It definitely looked like the entrance to a stable. There was a computer terminal at roughly the same spot, and there were pressurization pumps that surrounded the door's seal. The room had some metal plating on the walls, but most of it was still bare, exposing the structural framework underneath. The only thing missing were the zebra glyphs. None of the walls beyond the opening to the door were marked in any way.
Well, at least I can sleep a little better tonight.
It was then that I heard the organ play another distorted note, and I decided I'd seen enough. I entered the only hallway, getting as far away from Maricello as I could. The corridor quickly turned pitch black. I didn't have the ambient purple glow from the wall glyphs or phantoms anymore. I turned on my pip-buck light and stopped as soon as I reached the next room. I assumed I was far enough out of their reach, so I sat down to tend to my leg. I carefully leaned against the wall and levitated a box under my left hind hoof to keep the leg suspended. I pulled my dress away and felt a horrible pain as the sticky exposed skin clung to the fabric. I tilted my pip-buck lamp to get a good look at it. The wound was similar to a third-degree burn. Two of the layers of skin had been seared away while the ones below it had swelled and bubbled. I took out my antiseptic cream and coated the entire burned area, which covered everything basically from my tarsus joint to my fetlocks.
So basically half of the leg, Professor?
Yes. The cream hurt at first, but then the burning sensation went away and it felt better. I wrapped the wound with some healing bandages, which I hoped would work well enough. Finally, I took a big swig of vodka and ripped my dress off.
Once again, quite the party under different circumstances.
I'll say, but I wasn't thinking of anything like that at the time. All I wanted to do was sleep. I hadn't realized how exhausted I was. I had been up almost 24 hours while looking for the mansion, and had been through a very traumatic experience. I looked at my motion sensor and didn't detect anything in the area, so I set up a proximity alarm that would go off if anything came too close. I then reloaded my carbine rifle and the laser pistol and fell asleep using my dress as a pillow.
And you actually slept well like that?
I did. It was warm and comfortable down there because the weather in the swamplands was perpetually 75 degrees and humid. Although no longer being chased by a poltergeist definitely helped. I ended up sleeping for 12 straight hours, which did wonders for my leg. I stood up on all fours and was feeling much better. I could actually walk on my leg again. I changed the bandages and realized that it was already well past sunrise. I started thinking to myself, all of this mess started with sunset, so maybe they only exist at night. Wanting to prove my theory, I crept slowly back up the hallway with my pip-buck light off, trying as hard as I could not to make a sound. I reached the entrance room and saw rays of sunlight coming in from a cellar window. I walked up to the computer terminal at the center of the room, right next to the loading dock. The cellar looked totally clear. There weren't any phantoms, and I didn't see any of the glowing glyphs on the wall. Still, though, I didn't trust it. Something was gnawing at me in the back of my mind, so I pulled out my carbine and fired a shot. Two of the wine bottles outside of the door exploded in a splash of red and purple. That's when I saw two faint glows on each side of the metal doorway. The noses of two phantoms turned towards the sound, then quickly turned away.
They were going to ambush you from each side of the door? Clever girls.
It didn't bode well for me, though. There was no way I was leaving through the front door, even if there were fewer phantoms than before. So, I went with my only safe option. I turned on my pip-buck lamp and walked back down the hallway. The room where I slept was a lobby. There were several openings for lifts, but there were no cars in any of the shafts. Luckily, a large staircase circled down around the shafts, so I started walking down the empty concrete steps. I noticed that I was leaving hoofprints behind me. All of the walls and floors were coated in a fine purple dust. I walked down about 5 stories before reaching the bottom. It looked like Crescendo wasn't kidding when he said he'd do anything to save his family, because it looked like he has stolen a lot of bunker designs from StableTech to make his own stable. There were two hallways that branched out into male and female living quarters. One hallway had game rooms and other recreational activities, including an indoor hoofball court. One hallway led to some shops and mechanical rooms. Of course, none of the areas were finished. Most of them weren't much more than wall struts and loose electrical wiring. There were overhead lighting fixtures, but none of them had power, which was odd because the last hallway had a distinct purple glow.
Oh, goddesses, not again.
I pulled out my laser pistol and trotted slowly towards the hallway. The word atrium was written in painter's tape above the doorframe. When I got close enough to read it, I heard a click. Then another click. Then another. I glanced down at my pipbuck and noticed the rad meter was starting to rise. Something in there was radioactive. Knowing I had nowhere else to go, I took a deep breath and walked in. What I saw, I have to say, was probably the last thing I expected.
Well, what was it?
Sorry, I was pausing for dramatic effect.
Well, it looks like someone's become quite the radio personality. But with a pause like that, I thought you wanted me to go to the phones. Which is weird, because this isn't a call-in show. I mean, it's not like we could pull the listeners to hear their guesses. You know what? We'll do just that. All you listeners out there in post-apocalyptia, take out a piece of paper and write down what you think is in the atrium. Then go out and put it in some random mailbox. I know there's at least one mailmare left in the wasteland. We'll be right back.